Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Going to play a sound clip for you of what your brain does when you are watching a movie. What's happening? And that's what your brain is screaming. And that's from the 1982 movie Poltergeist. It makes the point that our brains are freaking out when we watch movies. That's what the movie experience can do, because it seems so real at times. We are so deeply moved when we watch great acting in well-made films. So on this day, when the Academy Award nominations are announced, let's talk about movies and how they impact your emotional life and why they seem so real. We invite you to join our conversation. Give us a call. What movies have really impacted you? The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You can email questions and comments to thesource@tpr.org. And we're joined by Jeffrey M. Zacks, professor of psychology at Washington University in St. Louis and author of the book Flicker, Your Brain on Movies. Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you, David.
So when we look at movies, you know, it's very artificial experience, actually. You're sitting in a dark room and there's these colored shadows being projected on the wall at this certain frame rate. But somehow our brain looks at those things and is transported into the storylines and into that space. And suddenly we lose ourselves in that experience. So you are studying why this happens?
Yeah. In my lab, we started off interested in how people understand real life and remember it and make decisions about it. And we're still super interested in that. But in order to study that, we started showing people movies. And at first, we tried to make them the dumbest little anti-movies you could. But we quickly realized that there's no way around the power of that medium. And over the years, I've become increasingly more interested in the questions that the medium itself poses.
Right. So we learn about POV, persistence of vision. It's also used to describe point of view, two different things, but they both imply a part of in the movies. So, but persistence of vision, why is that important when talking about films and why we're able to interpret this phenomenon as an actual thing to watch?
Yeah, that's a great place to start. The lore is that persistence of vision, which is the fact that when a photon of light hits your retina, the consequences of that aren't instantaneous, but they persist for a while. The lore was that that was what was responsible for the perception of motion in film. So the idea is you get one image, and then you get a little bit of a blank interval, and then you get another image. And that persistence of vision bridges representations of what's up on the screen from one frame to the other, and that's how you perceive motion. And it's a really intuitive explanation. The only problem with it is that it's wrong. It turns out that if you kind of think it through, you can figure it out. So if that was really what was going on, if you were mentally superimposing those two frames, what you'd wind up with is a blur, not a sense of motion. And it turns out that what's going on is that we have specialized parts of our brain that are sensitive to changes over space and time. So, for example, maybe a dot moving from left to right on the left part of my visual field at a particular speed. And if the successive frames of the movie approximate the stimulation that real motion would provide, then that part of my brain responds. So it's not that it has to stitch anything together, it just responds directly to the spatiotemporal profile of the stimulus.
And so our brains are geared towards tracking movement and color because we're supposed to be running through the Serengeti looking for something to eat. And now we're sitting in a theater, a comfy theater, air conditioning with popcorn in our lap, and we're watching someone else running through the Serengeti looking for something to eat. But we can't tell the difference.
Yeah, that's the bigger picture, is that the brain that you bring into the theater did not evolve to watch movies. It evolved to deal with the real world, and a real world in which stuff out there is important to you. Some of it you've got to eat, some of it you've got to avoid being eaten by. And your brain evolved to allow you to respond rapidly and fluently and adaptively to those real world situations. And when you show up in the theater, you know, your brain gets visual inputs that are very similar to the visual inputs it gets from live action, and it responds for the most part in ways that are very similar to the way it responds to live action. And then you've got to do a little bit of extra work to try and suppress some of those responses that if it were reality, they'd be totally adaptive. But if you're watching a movie and it can't actually hurt you and it can't actually feed you, then it doesn't make sense to be running away or reaching out to grab that juicy apple.
You know, in the very first motion picture exhibitions, you know, the silent films and black and white, and they would show the locomotive hurling towards the audience, and people were literally running out of the theater when this was happening because they couldn't tell the difference between the two experiences.
Yeah, that's a famous story about a film by the Lumiere brothers, who were two of the founders of motion pictures, and the stories that they showed this film of a train coming into the station and people ran from the theater. And it was reproduced wonderfully in the film Hugo by Martin Scorsese recently.
And I think that Buster Keaton also played with that.
Yeah, but it turns out that original story isn't, as far as we can tell, it didn't really quite happen that way.
Right. So, but it tells us that this is a powerful tool and experience. This is where, you know, we're talking about it. We love the movies. Everyone talks about the movies, but something is happening inside our skull when we're sitting in a theater, and how do we know what is happening is a positive thing?
Well, a simple way is to just ask people, right? And and for sure, it's not always a positive thing. You know, I have scary movies that I saw 20 years ago that still freak me out in the middle of the night, and most of us have seen images on screens that we've found disturbing. But both of those positives and negatives attest to the power of the medium and its ability to stimulate the neural systems that we evolved to deal with regulating our live behavior.
Right, an emotional impact that we have. Like many of the tough guys, you know, people, you know, they don't want to be emoting during the day, but you put them in front of a terms of endearment, and here comes the waterworks. It triggers a reaction, and not necessarily associated directly with the film, but it stimulates, and here it comes.
Yeah. So one interesting thing about how tearjerkers like that work is that they can use the same kinds of mechanisms that provoke emotion in our actual lives, but just crank up all the knobs to ranges that are outside of what we would get in real life. So one source of emotional response, and there you can trace some of the neurophysiology of how this works, is from seeing a facial expression, somebody laughing or more powerfully crying, to unconsciously mirroring that facial expression, to activating the emotion program that's associated with that facial expression. All of that happens super fast and outside of awareness. And in a movie, you know, in real life, if I'm seeing someone go through an awful emotional situation and they're crying, it's pretty easy for me to avoid that situation, to look away. But if that face is filling up half the screen, it's going to get me whether I want it to or not.
Okay, we're going to be talking about mirroring a little bit more and some other phenomenon that drives the movies and why they're so powerful. We're going to continue our conversation, take some phone calls. The number is 210-614-8980. What experiences that you've had watching a film has had a direct impact on your life? This is The Source on KSTX.
We are pleased to announce the films selected as the Best Picture nominees. They are American Sniper, Clint Eastwood, Robert Lorenz.
And the Oscars Academy Award nominees announced today. We're taking the occasion to talk about why movies are so impactful, why we pay so much attention to them, what are they doing to our brains. With me to do that, Jeffrey M. Zaks. He is a professor of psychology at Washington University in St. Louis. His book is called Flicker Your Brain on Movies. And that's a play on, you know, your brain on drugs, I guess, because is watching movies, is that like a drug?
Oh, that's a great. That wasn't quite how I meant it. I stole it more directly from my friend Dan Levitin, who wrote the great book Your Brain on Music. But he stole it from Your Brain on Drugs. And both of these things, you know, the analogy to chemically messing with your brain isn't too far off. We do all these things to create experiences. You know, we can do it chemically, we can do it by throwing on headphones and getting immersed in a piece of music, and we can do it by sitting down in a theater and getting immersed in a screen. These are all ways that we tweak our brains for entertainment.
All right, let's take some phone calls. What are your favorite movies? What kind of emotion did you get from these films, and how were you transported by them? Do you still think about that film today? Another persistence of vision is how you continue our cast back into that film. The number is 210-614-8980, and Kathy has called in. And Kathy, welcome to The Source.
Hi, thanks. My comment is the movie that really affected me was Philadelphia. I'm a child of the 90s, and so I never experienced the AIDS scare of the 1980s. And so watching that movie was just so powerful. It really brought it home to me.
All right, Kathy, thanks. Thank you for that. 1993, Tom Hanks film, Denzel Washington. With being transported to another place and walking in someone else's shoes, we hear about that's one of the great things about movies. That's why I like the movie Drumline so much, because it brings me to an experience that I never had and I would never have, but suddenly there it is.
Yeah, when you talk about, you know, movies as a way of tweaking your brain, one of the great things that films can do is give us perceptual, emotional, cognitive experiences that are out of reach in real life, either because they are impractical, so, you know, jumping out of an airplane for a lot of people, or transgressive, or threatening. We wouldn't want to go there without knowing that we can get up out of the seat and leave.
All right, let's take another caller. This is from Gregory. Gregory, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. You know, my daughter and I were watching the movie God's Not Dead. And that was a very powerful movie for my daughter and I, who's 10 years old, because of the message that it sent about, you know, how some people through past experiences in their lives have lost faith in God, and how this particular movie actually, you know, communicated the message, and the actors, how they did a phenomenal job of, you know, relaying and communicating that message to the audience, and it was very emotional for us. So it was a really good movie for us, and kind of made us think a little bit.
So God's Not Dead, a film that was released in 2014, not nominated for any Oscars, I don't think, Gregory.
It wasn't, but you know, it's part of a larger group that has a lot of different movies that are for family oriented, and it kind of sends a really good message out to the families about, you know, even though we have things that happen in our lives, it's actually kind of good to kind of stay focused and to be really, you know, keep our faith.
All right, sir. Thank you for calling in. Appreciate that. So, Jeffrey, you know, these religious films, people, you know, is there a close connection between films that talk about spirituality and spirituality and religion and stuff?
That's a great question. I wish I knew more. There's not much research on the connection between the movie experience and religious experience. I can tell you that if you want to induce a strong emotional response, be it a response of, you know, happiness or sadness or awe, that, you know, showing people a movie or playing music at them are two of the best ways to do it.
I've talked to people about films in the past, and they say, "Oh, they in their spiritual beliefs, and they'll mention a movie, and it'll be like Ghost, you know. It's like Ghost. They think that afterlife is like Ghost. And it's like that was a work of fiction. That it was not supposed to be a someone's philosophy about life after death. but it was so powerful to people that they see it that way.
Yeah, I mean, the ideas get in, and we don't segregate very well. Ideas that get in from sources that are clearly marked as fiction, be they stories or movies. Or political propaganda. The ability to do that segregation is called source memory, and it's hard. There are specialized parts of the brain that are particularly important for it, and if those get injured or if they get affected by neurodegenerative disorders, you can have profound impairments in source memory. And so you can see these really tragic cases where people just confuse, frankly, fictional incidents with as having happened in their real lives. But But at a more mundane level, you know, this happens to us all the time. If you think about your knowledge about historical events, if it's an event that you've seen a movie about, how sure are you that that was really what you read in ninth grade history and not really what you saw in the film drama?
So when you watch the film Lincoln, the Steven Spielberg film, that's going to shape people's opinions more so than what they learned in grade school?
Perhaps. I mean, especially because that's such a powerful portrayal. But the more important thing is you can't really keep them separate. I think there's a particularly live issue this week, right? Because we've got all these historically informed movies in the Oscar nominees.
Like Selma.
Right? We got Selma.
And the controversy about how it portrays LBJ in that film, which is inaccurate.
Exactly. Well, so I'm not going to go there talking to an audience of Texans, right? but, you know, we've also got The Imitation Game. So there's more there. So now in Theory of Everything.
Right. So are they retroconning history when they make a movie about these things? So let's talk about the mirror rule and about how this works when we watch a film and how I'm watching any performance on the screen and somehow I am going to be invoked into an emotion. I mean, why can't I just watch it and just study it as a story? Why do I have to feel anything?
Yeah. So for us and for lots of other species, it's adaptive often if we're going to coordinate our behavior with our family and friends and neighbors to act in a way that's congruent with what they're doing. So if you're chasing down an animal and the person ahead of you jumps, you want to get ready to jump. If somebody waves at you, you want to wave back.
So we have to model our behavior.
And so so our nervous systems are built to coordinate behavior. And one of the tools that's built in is this tendency to mirror. It won't get you all the way there, but it's good in a lot of situations. And so that evolved for life outside of the theater, but it happens in the theater. And so if somebody up on the screen, even a character you don't like, is smiling, your face is going to tend to work itself into a more smiley pose. And then the second piece is that our emotional programs are these kind of unified constructs that include the subjective experience and the state of your brain and also the state of the peripheral parts of your body, the muscles in your face. And so when you activate that smiling component of that emotion program, it tends to bring along the rest of the program with it. So once you're smiling, even if you're not aware that you're smiling, you're going to tend to be in a better mood. So that's one of several mechanisms by which a film can produce a strong emotion rapidly without you having as much control over it as you might think.
As Charlie Chaplin said, smile even though your heart is breaking.
Exactly.
Let's get David on the line. He's called in. Hey, David, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I'm an artist, and I was wondering, I use films both as inspiration and as entertainment, and I was wondering how people relate to films and how that's different to the way that they relate to paintings or interact with paintings and their responses to those different media.
Thank you for that great question, David.
Yeah, that's a great one. So there's an important component that I think is where the lesson is the same. So in both cases, the way the medium works on your brain depends on the fact that your brain didn't evolve to deal with paintings or films. It evolved to deal with a dynamic three-dimensional world with which you can interact. And so when you look at a painting, even though it's flat, people's brains process the depth cues in the painting to give them back a sense of a three-dimensional structure. And that's going to happen independent of the artist's intent or independent of maybe the introduction of deliberately conflicting depth cues. And so that gives you a bunch of opportunities as an artist to mess with people. But there are, of course, some differences between looking at a painting and watching a film. In general, you got a lot more control as the viewer over your experience with the painting. You can take it in at your own pace. You can look at it from different angles. The artifact, it sits there and waits for you, whereas a film keeps moving. And so the director has a tremendous amount of control over your perceptual experience.
Yeah, but there's also like watching plays, a drama on stage, or watching a video game, or even reading a book. Are you going to get the same kind of experience that you would by watching a film?
Yeah, and so each of these media has its own affordances. So just take plays versus movies for a second. So there's a kind of control that you have in movies that you don't have in plays. And in plays, you're basically always working with a long shot. You've got a whole scene, and the viewer can choose where in that scene they're going to focus their attention. In a movie, you spend a lot of your time in close-ups where the director has decided for you what you're going to be able to look at, right? Most of the scene that's being depicted isn't shown. So that's one difference.
You're being manipulated in the process.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're paying good money to be manipulated. So that's all good. But the ways that you're manipulated depend on the medium.
Right. The bigger the screen, the bigger the pop.
Yes. There's data on that.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much. I hope you didn't, break the magic box by showing us how this is working, how movies impact our brain, why we feel what we feel when we watch these artificial constructions. Thank you so much. The book is Flicker. Jeffrey M. Zaks is the author. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, David.
And this is The Source on KSTX. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is produced by Paul Flav and David Martin Davies. Our chief engineer is Doug C. DeMore. Management and oversight provided by VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Production assistance is provided by me, Ruben Garcia. The Source is a production of Texas Public Radio. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.